Hello and welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. You are now listening to Grievances of Scott with myself, Alistair Melling. Grievances of Scott is a show focused around bringing big issues into discussion, such as homelessness, feminism, geopolitical crises, and economic issues, and even Scottish independence. Today, we are joined by Serbulent Turan to discuss the purpose of government and what it is in general. Serbulent is a PhD candidate here in the political science department at UBC, British Columbia, obviously. He specializes in political theory and is, in particular, the constitution and legitimacy of political authorities, norms of political obligation and social discipline. His dissertation, Patterns and of Obedience, Dreams, Demons and the Dead, investigates historical contingencies in European history that were instrumental in bringing around modern democratic concepts of citizenry, political obligation, and obedience to political authority. So thank you very much for that piece. Did you write that in the UBC?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, you did. Nice that you're familiar with that. So, welcome, Serbulent.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. First of all, I've got to say my first grievance of the day, but I'd hoped to play a 15-minute interview which I had with a girl called Zina Dami, who is the president of the Women's Center here, in which we discussed the recent visit by GAP, which is the Genocide Awareness Project, a group that focuses on using graphic images of events such as the Holocaust, the Armenian Genocide, and aborted fetuses. In order to raise awareness for the similarities the group sees between abortion and genocide. So unfortunately, I can't play that today, but I'm going to be discussing abortion and a number of other issues probably next week. So for now, we only have Serbulent. What a shame. But for the next 15 minutes, I believe we're going to be discussing the role of government. So we're just going to take a quick PSA break, because I'm required to play that in the first 10 minutes, I believe. And then we'll be back for a 15-minute discussion discussing what is government, split into four parts, what is government, what makes government seem legitimate, the issues with democracy and accountability, and finally, revolution, what the internet and social media are doing to challenge governments today. So all that to come in the next 50 minutes. I think that's fine.
Outreach Students Association offers students the chance to learn about global health and international development while providing students with opportunities for practical experience working within disadvantaged communities both locally and internationally.
To the mic.
They also collaborate with other clubs to organize global health-related symposiums and competitions. Executive positions are available. Contact them at ubc.gosa@gmail.com.
Attention grad students. Share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
Okay, welcome back. Apologies for the conversation that went on throughout the PSA break. We had a little bit of a technical issue where the lights don't actually show that I'm speaking. Anyway, so, as I said, we're going to be discussing what is government, first of all, and I've got a couple of quotes before we move into the actual thing. For example, Thomas Jefferson believed the purpose of government is to enable the people of a nation to live in safety and happiness. Government exists for the interests of the governed, not for the governors. However, on the other hand, we have Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, who says, to be governed is to be watched, inspected, spied upon, directed, law-driven, numbered, regulated, enrolled, indoctrinated, preached at, controlled, checked, estimated, valued, censored, commanded by creatures who have neither the right nor the wisdom nor the virtue to do so. To be governed is to be at every operation, at every transaction, noted, registered, counted, taxed, stamped, measured, numbered, assessed, licensed, authorized, admonished, prevented, forbidden, reformed, corrected, punished. It is under the pretext of public utility and in the name of general interest to be placed under contribution, drilled, fleeced, exploited, monopolized, extorted from, squeezed, hoaxed, robbed. Then, at the slightest resistance, the first word of complaint, to be repressed, fined, vilified, harassed, hunted down, abused, clubbed, disarmed, bound, choked, imprisoned, judged, condemned, shot, deported, sacrificed, sold, betrayed, and to crown all, mocked, ridiculed, derided, outraged, dishonored. That is government, that is its justice, and that is its morality. So those are big words, kind of a big introduction to what government should be. First of all, I want to ask you, so in your opinion, what is government for you? And how would you define its purpose in terms of what it should be, or what you actually see its function in society is today?
Well, it's a massive question, but if we have to go by its bare bones, a government is mankind's almost universal answer to a couple of challenges that rise automatically from living in a society. And if we have to really get down to the barest bones of it, then we're going to have three challenges. The first one is the distribution of resources. The second one is the settlement of dispute. And the third and the last one that actually covers all of it is the problem of authority. So a government is basically an answer to all these three challenges that rise up anytime human beings combine together to live as a society. So that's what a government is. That's what it always was. What it is today is a different issue, because these are really as minor as it gets in a government's functions. So today, governments do so many other things. As you have read, quoted from Jefferson, you know, it's about the happiness of the governed, it's about their safety, it's about their security, and so on and so forth. So every time you add something more to these three basics that I just described, you're actually adding something more to the government. And I think it's maybe part of the human nature that the system, the normativity that you're born into becomes normal for you. So you expect your government to actually fulfill these functions as well. And then maybe others, and then maybe even more. So people who are born in welfare states actually would define the government as something that would provide welfare. People who are born with minimal government would probably define government as something that really stays away. And this is one of the difficulties of pinning down what a government is. Mm-hmm. Universally speaking.
Okay. I think it was Timothy Leary who defined what he thought was government also. He said he was happy to live under the least intrusive mafia of the time, which was the American government. To what extent is do you think that the government could be seen, this is certainly my opinion, or a semi-formed opinion, that government is essentially the most successful mafia system. It's the one that sort of it's in the same way that mafias can benefit society. It's not that I'm attaching much of a negative side to the mafia, or a positive to the government. But mafias control certain parts of society. They obviously give something back, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to stay in power. But in the same way that they demand commission, governments demand tax. It's just, do you see it as a different word for the same thing?
Well, actually, no. The mob and the government comparison is one that's often made by, you know, even the biggest names in political science. Like one of those, the now late Charles Tilly, actually uses this analogy quite often. It is quite literally a very, very successful mafia organization, and from the beginnings too, that was the same case. Like, if you can imagine, like, you're living in your village and this guy comes and taxes you, it's really not very different from this guy who comes and takes your money in return for, you know, not killing you.
Protection money.
That's basically it. And it's really not very difficult to find these things in history. And it has been found again and again that the successful lords become, you know, the basic foundation work of the government. And the unsuccessful lords become highwaymen and outlaws and so on and so forth. Okay. So this is actually this very clear distinction in the beginning. And it lies at the successful highwayman, let's say, becomes the cornerstone of a government.
Okay.
And that's so it's a mostly used analogy.
And in terms of the welfare state, what do you think of the benefits and the disadvantages within the welfare state?
Well, that's a very difficult question. There are many benefits to living in a welfare state. And, you know, because basically when you're living in a society, you're giving up quite a lot. And we're not just talking about being taxed, but you're agreeing not to do many things. And the sad part is you're agreeing in such a way that you don't even know that you're agreeing to it. Mm-hmm. So the welfare state is basically that society standing up for each other, supporting each other. Because the basic assumption behind having a state is that we as a society, we are one. So we're ruled, we're governed by this one entity that represents us, that, you know, holds this community over us, that protects us from outsiders. So the idea of having an in-group is ingrained within the logic of governance. So welfare state then means that this is us standing up for each other. The disadvantages is, of course, you know, some people may not be overly happy with having to do work for other people. Some people may not be buying into this illusion of togetherness, this imagined communities, as it was called in political science. So some people may not feel like contributing for others who are not maybe working as hard or in their perception or not working, you know, as dedicated in an as dedicated way and so on and so forth. But the major downside, I would say, is that it's basically reallocation of resources in such a way that some people are not happy with that. Mm-hmm. That's the basic problem.
Also, I think, to a certain extent, and it's become very apparent within the more wealthy Western nations, in order to maintain their sort of control over the world, they've had to heavily subsidize a lot of their larger industries. So some of the biggest subsidies in the US, they go to the agriculture, the agribusiness. And essentially, for me, that... It's money coming from the government. It's a reallocation of resources, and there's no difference ultimately between the money that goes to an underprivileged family in terms of food stamps and a major corporation that's receiving subsidies. First of all, I wanted to maybe question: is there any direct injustice of this, and we should be surprised? And I also wanted to mention that Walmart, for example, is actually the biggest indirect recipient of welfare, because it pays its workers in such a so lowly that the government has to step in and supply its hand out food stamps and various welfare to the workers in order for them to live, and so essentially subsidizes cheap labor for Walmart. So should we be surprised that governments, actually almost all governments by my empirical observations, that they tend to towards handing out more money to the people who are within maybe their social spheres and call it different names, such as subsidies, rather than welfare, which it is. So is this a surprise, or do you even agree with that statement?
Well, yes, of course, and of course I would agree with that, but I'm also not really surprised. But that draws from the issue that we were just discussing about the welfare. When people oppose welfare on the grounds that, well, you know what, I don't want to give my money to a bunch of lazy people who are not doing any work, what is really happening is people are just fighting back on grounds where they can perceive they have a chance to fight back. Most of the states are militarized states. And the money that goes into military is immeasurably more than the money that goes into welfare. Similarly, for example, the money that the U.S. government had to give and after the 2008 meltdown to financial institutions far surpasses anything that you can ever imagine. It's more than the sum of several state-funded programs, including the landing of the moon, the Vietnam War, even the Iraq War, and so on and so forth. The issue is people are somewhat convinced that this is one of the building blocks of the society that we exist within. And they deem this natural, normal, even necessary for the governments to channel funds into these institutions so that life as we know it can continue. And of course, if you are one of those institutions that is receiving this massive amount of money, it is greatly in your interest to actually propagate this kind of belief that, yeah, you know, if I don't get that kind of money, then, you know, the economic system will collapse and that's going to be anarchy. So this is strongly in your interest to propagate that kind of belief. Mm. So, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to have to bring that section to an end, but it's nicely linked on to our next bit, next section, which is what makes government seem legitimate, what makes us actually accept the current status quo within all of this. So you've been listening to Grievances of the Scot with myself, Alistair Melling, and we're today joined by Serpilin Turan, who is obviously a professor here, and join us in 1 minute just for a quick PSA break for the before we move on to the next section.
My vegetables, I'm gonna chow down. My vegetables, I love you most of all. My favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies. It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce. It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems. Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply. Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Hello and welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. So we're joined by Serpilin Turan. Yeah, and next section we're going to move on to is what makes the government seem legitimate. So we were just talking about how the many injustices it seems where the reallocation of resources tend to go towards the wealthy instead of the poor. But it seems that many people seem to find this status quo acceptable and only really challenge, I think what you said, what they believe they can actually directly change rather than these more broad injustices within society. The quotes I want to start with is briefly on, I think, 2 days ago, Noam Chomsky, as he constantly comes out with more and more quotes on Twitter, said, people do not want, or often not able to, perceive that they are conforming to external authority. They feel themselves to be very, very free, and indeed are, as long as they conform. And I think we were just talking about a nine-gag simplified experiment that allegedly went on, although I don't believe either of us managed to find any source confirming this. But it's still very interesting to look from how we in society operate under this this system. Basically, the experiment went where they had five monkeys. And you're free to jump in if you feel I'm missing something out. They had five monkeys, and well, that's the number they claim. Then they had, at the top of this ladder or something that had to be climbed, they had treats. Will that be bananas or what have you? And what they did is every single time a monkey tried to climb up this to get the treats, they would shower the other monkeys with water. Obviously rather unpleasant. And each time they repeated this until the monkeys actually learned that by climbing up this ladder, everyone else would get everyone would also get showered. And so they began to violently prevent any of their fellow monkeys from climbing up and getting this treat. What they eventually then started to do was replace one monkey at a time. So they took one monkey out and replaced it with a monkey that hadn't actually been introduced to the system. What did it do? It climbed up to try and get the treats, and all the other monkeys beat it down. They then continued this experiment, replacing one monkey for another monkey for another monkey until no monkeys of the original that had been showered on remained. So none of the monkeys had been ever received this the water shower, but yet they still continued to do. They still continued with the same behavior of beating anybody who tried to climb up to get to the treat. And so, despite not being actually scientifically tested, it definitely is somewhat of a, what do you call them, not metaphor, it's the old tales, the old proverbs of sort of old times, of the way human nature tends to conform quite often without questioning. So the first question I want to ask is, so what what does this say about human nature, and why are we so susceptible as a species to blind obedience?
Well, first of all, I'm not denying in any way all these massive commonalities between humans and all the other primates, but I would be very cautious of drawing parallels between human political behavior and monkeys climbing on a ladder, even if that was a real experiment, because I really couldn't find anything proving that that really has been done. And if it hasn't been done, I really think it's a fantastic idea. Somebody should really just try that's the point, right? So the question that you were asking is, what makes government seem legitimate? And that's the sad part of it, that the legitimacy is in the eye of the beholder. And what the beholder sees is shown to that particular beholder throughout his life by the centralized institution. So today we look back in time and we observe the Egyptian times or even the Middle Ages, and we just think, I can't believe people put up with that. Well, the thing is, of course you can't believe people put up with that, because you're a man of a different age. The truth is, the Egyptians believed, for example, and we're talking about this, of course, Egyptians before Common Era, they believed that it's the pharaoh that is keeping up the sky, and the pharaoh needs their obedience to keep the sky up. Otherwise, they believed that the sky would collapse. So their obedience were not really actually obeying that one particular oppressive authority, but it was actually helping the world keep going on. Because if they didn't obey, if they disobeyed, then they genuinely believed that, you know what, this world is going to collapse. So once you have this belief from, I don't know, 5, 4, 3-year-old and so on and so forth, then of course you will obey authority no matter what's the cost. We see the same thing in Plato, who wants to, in his own republic, he says that he's going to build the best city ever, the Kallipolis, the just city. And for that, he needs only kids younger than 10. Because it's very easy to condition kids to say, this is the right way to go. And once you're conditioned that way, well, then you see things are legitimate for you.
Okay. Also, I often find myself, when I'm thinking about my own time and questioning how can I possibly believe that, it then forces me to look at my own position. And maybe in the future, we won't have such a thing as democracy, or this concept of representative democracy. It may seem abhorrent to us, the idea of money. And so it's very, very interesting to see how systems that you just went through completely unquestioningly. And I think I've only started doing it this year. Started looking into why do we accept these social norms. So I often find it very difficult to, like, what's ultimately the difference, because we're just, I guess it's living in the now that makes it seem different and new and especially different from before. Whereas there won't be, in, let's say, 300, 400, 500 years' time, much distinguishment between right now and, say, 200, 300 years before now, or let's say 500 years before now, when we accepted the state. Sorry, when we accepted religion as being, or at least from the Western point of view. It's another problem that we often have, that we, especially within Europe and in the West, we sort of take a sort of very Eurocentric point of view and forget that there are many other models that we can look to that happened before. So what I also wanted to relate it to is that, so generally there is this form of control. Would you agree in the fact that we had the state, before we had religion, we can say from the 1000 controlling most things, then you can say after the 30-year war, which broke down a lot of the religious control over Europe, we had this idea of the state coming in rather than Christendom, which controlled most of Europe up until that point. This is sort of the era of the states, and you can say, I mean, you're my professor here, and we've been doing a lot about the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment, for me, it seems that it was them trying to justify a great, they were trying to justify their own positions of power without the concept of supernaturalism, without supernatural, without saying, oh, it's just up there. It's just believe in this guy in the sky who controls everything, watches over everything we do. And it's sort of a justified for the new people who have taken power. And the one thing, the final question I wanted to, one of the questions I wanted to ask is, I think Lenin once said that if you took any revolutionary and put him on the throne of Russia, within a year he would have turned into a monster far worse than the leader that he deposed. And so, for you, is there any actually such thing as a benevolent leader?
That's a very tough one. Yes, of course, many leaders really genuinely go into this business because they want to do good. We have many, many psychological studies that actually show that, you know, modern politicians do have some sort of psychological abnormality that is not commonly found, and that's like lust for power. Mm-hmm. That's not really common in everybody. That being said, most people, despite this, go into politics. Most people go into governing business because they think they can do good. They can do some good. I think it's a very rare person and a particular sociopath who would go into this entire business just for himself and just for just to get personal benefits. I mean, of course, a lot of them are getting personal benefits, but they may be just perks of the job. A lot of them are going into this, I'm quite convinced, to do some good. That being said, once you get inside, I mean, I'm not insensitive to the actual difficulties of, you know, this is one ethical question that is always thrown around in philosophy courses, like, would you kill one man to save 100? Well, we have this luxury of talking about this. We have this luxury of saying, I don't know, I don't care, I know I'm never gonna. But these people sometimes face these things, and it's really difficult to put everything on them. So to give the answer to your original question, do I believe in a benevolent leader? Yes, I think a lot of leaders, even the worst ones, are genuinely operating under the assumption that they're doing some good. And I'm talking...
Can you point to examples?
Well, my country's prime minister is awful to say that.
That's Turkey.
Yes, there were protests against him last summer, and 8 people were killed by the police. One was lynched in front of cameras by like 12 people. Another one just shot, again, recorded live by a cop. And so he went on air and he said, oh, this is just my police fighting legendarily. They're just writing a legend against these hordes of chaotic whatever. But... And I think he really means that he's trying to do some good. And I think he's one of the worst prime ministers ever. That being said, he genuinely believes, and so does half of the country, that he's doing a good job, that he's doing this for the betterment of Turkey. So we can see the same example with Mubarak. We can see the same example with Gaddafi in Libya, who was shot. And, you know, ironically, Gaddafi's Libya was the only country in Africa who provided fresh water to 99% of its population. That's the only country. That does not mean that Gaddafi was not a bloody dictator, because he was. That being said, he did some good, and he believed he was doing some good. The same goes for Bashar Assad in Syria right now. He took the post somewhat unwittingly from his dead brother. Well, his dead brother was supposed to take over from his father, but when he died, whatever. So he had to step in. And he did a really amazing job keeping this country together. And it's a very diverse, very different country. And, you know, the moment he lost his grip, you can see what's happening in Syria. There's a civil war that's going on for quite some time. So was he a dictator? Yes, he still is. Did he do some good? Yes, he did some good. So that's actually the heart of the issue. What do you expect from your government? Do you expect from your government just safety and security from this guy next door? Or, you know, do you expect something else? Do you expect, I don't know, respect? Do you expect to live a dignified life? Or are you content so long as you can live in safety and, you know, and maybe you have some food on the table and a roof on top of your head? Are you content with these things? And if that's the case, then maybe the dictator is right for you. Mm. And, you know, there's really nothing in our experience that tells us the dictators are always bad.
Okay. I can definitely personally draw a lot of... coming into the radio show, for example, this is where I want to draw the similarity. what I was always confident in doing is voicing my opinions within within groups of people or one-on-one. But when you come into the radio, for example, it's a completely different ballgame. You don't just consider the other person. You've got to consider that you're speaking to a wider audience. And it becomes the skills that you had developed in terms of charming or persuading people and giving them decent, interesting arguments before when I was out just speak. This is what made me think I could do the radio, because I could engage people with many complicated conversations. But the moment you come in here, it's completely different. And it's difficult. It's very, very challenging being having to run your own show by yourself. And I think within all of that, you've also got to understand that for me is an environmental change, or structural environment change. And the people who come in when they come in with these good intentions, it's easier, I think, maybe to look at it from the mafia comparison. That imagine a mafia boss coming in, and the amount of people he's got to step on to get to the top. It takes a lot of apathy, I think, for you to actually get to the top. And that you've got, because especially when it comes if you can look at the structure with more. That has more. If you imagine a pyramid, if you imagine it particularly narrow, narrow at the bottom and then just keeps going up and up and up, rather than a wide, which represents a far more unequal society. Unequal society is a very wide-based pyramid. The pyramid that's tall and thin means that you have to personally step on more people, and you see more of their emotions when you're more in contact with them. And that, I think that's where politicians actually get this apathy from, because they've had to step on so many people to get to that top. The system automatically produces people who are going to be particularly apathetic, or particularly, we can sort of take a step back and say cruel to the people around them. But I think also potentially to add, maybe not actually. I'll avoid that issue. I think we're going to have to take a quick PSA break. We've got two more discussions to go. We've also got to do the issue with democracy and accountability, and then we're moving on to revolutions, which I believe you wrote your thesis.
Still writing it.
You're still writing. Yeah. When does it get published?
That's not a polite question to ask. Well, I have to first finish it. Yeah. So it's maybe another year so, and then publication comes after.
Oh, okay. Well, all that and more. You've been listening to Grievances of a Scot with myself, Alistair Melling, and today we have Mr. Serbulent Turan on, talking about the roles of a government and what their purpose is within our society. All that and more. We've got two more sections to cover in the next 25 minutes. And
I'm going to be around my vegetables. I'm going to chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all.
Sprouts, you've ate here before. Community Eats is back for the summer.
We are your local food co-op.
We are your volunteer opportunity.
We are your meeting place.
We are your nutritious Friday lunch.
We are sustainability.
We are community.
Eats every Friday.
Come by with a reusable container, donate, and tell us what community means to you. Friday, 11:30 to 3 p.m. Food, fun, friends.
Hello and welcome. Can you hear me? Hello and welcome back to CITR. 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You're listening to the show Grievances of a Scot with myself, Alistair Melling, and Serbulent Turan. We're just discussing about what makes government seem legitimate, and now we're moving on to the issue of the issues of with democracy and its accountability. So specifically focusing on this, we're going to talk about banks and corporations and sort of what it appears to have what our society has appeared to change into, which is a bit of a corporatocracy, or many people like claiming. So we're going to explore some of those issues. I think we'll start with a few quotes from the Rothschilds. I think it's debatable who said this, but it says, "I care not who sits on the throne of the British Empire. Give me control of its currency, and I shall control the empire." And then he rather sincerely adds, this is Nathan Rothschild, "I do control the pound," and still is the currency of the lesser British Empire. And then it's also mixed with Mayor Rothschild's, it's, "Let me control the nation's currency, and I care not who writes its laws." Probably copied from his father, I think. So within all this, the question I wanted to ask is, we face a lot of problems within our democracies in terms of accountability, and these are being shown more and more as an issue that we're going to cover next a little bit with the spread of the rapid exponential sharing of information which the internet constitutes. We're beginning to know a lot more about the dirty dealings of our governments. There have been obviously people who have been publishing about this for centuries, but it's becoming more of a wider issue. And so to what extent, I wanted to ask, is government controlled by banks and corporations? And maybe even to that end, to what extent can we consider the banks and corporations separate or part of the government?
Well, that's a massively wide question. We have to acknowledge that we're talking about the Western governments mostly, I assume. Mm-hmm. And even then, banks and corporations are now a bit... I don't think they suffice to capture where money reaches at this particular point. And so if we actually had to maybe twitch the question just a little bit to what extent governments are controlled by money, well, if not full extent, then something very close to that. So I don't believe in any sense that that money at the current level... Let's speak just about North America. I don't believe that money can be extracted from the system anymore without actually harming the system greatly. They're so intertwined to such a great extent. And this all has got to do with, well, there are, of course, historical contingencies, that the rise of the early modern state and coincides with the rise of capitalism and, you know, the capitalist classes taking more and more power within the state, just loaning money in return for privileges and so on and so forth. So moneyed class becoming the new nobility is actually a couple of centuries old. That fact, and it's really established as fact right now, is a couple of centuries old. And it's only to be expected that this new nobility behaves just like the old nobility, in the sense that they own the state, they recognize the owners of the state as one of their own, they behave in a way that would really give all kinds of hints that it's theirs. And that's the thing, it's justifiably so. There's really no use denying it. We have seen the 2008 economical crisis. We're still witnessing the fallout in all over Europe. I mean, like, Greece is still experiencing this, Spain, France, and so on and so forth. All these austerity measures that you're seeing in Europe, they're all, if not the direct consequence of it, then something very close to that, of this 2008 economical crisis. That actually really speaks to the Rothschilds quote that you just said, that if you control money, if you can cause crises from an economic perspective, then, you know, governments kneel to you, and sometimes quite literally kneel to you, because, you know, they do kind of do need you to be stable. They need you to stand out for them. And we're just talking about governments here. If we need to talk to the politicians who are within the governments, I mean, this is just... it's just beating a dead horse. It's been said tens of thousands of times that the politicians need money to run their campaigns. And the moneyed class, of course, in that sense, kind of own them.
Okay. But, and so the thing is, within all this, is that... okay. So you're essentially saying that we can't call ourselves... democracy, obviously, meaning ruled by the people. When it comes to the point where... these corporations, the banks, they have far, far more voice within decisions made within government, it then becomes very difficult to actually call, I think, ourselves
To be honest, policy-making processes, so what a government does, these processes are completely closed to the demos, the public. The public has very little to no access to what's happening behind these doors. Mm-hmm. What the public can do is to choose between A and B, and sometimes quite literally A and B, option A and option B, and nothing else. And, you know, this is not really what democracy was all about. So in some senses, we do have aspects of a democracy, but I don't think that what we have now in most Western countries can be called a genuine democracy. We do not have the institutions designed to support the genuine democracy, and we most certainly do not have the demos, who is supposed to make informed, thoughtful decisions on how to direct that communal unit that is the society. So it's more like, you know, publicities, which guy is the coolest, which guy is the more charismatic, which guy speaks to you more, and so on and so forth. And once you elect this guy to office, then that's probably the full extent of a very large portion of the demos engagement with politics, actually.
Yeah, I think this is actually a very interesting quote from, do you know George Carlin? Yes. The comedian, of course. He says, Americans are given the illusion of choice. You can get, I think it's 36 flavors of ice cream. You can choose between Burger King, McDonald's, many different kinds of burgers, fast food. But you only get two choices with the government. You only get choice of, I think, between four or five companies that are going to, for insurance. And in terms of your food, 90% of it comes from four or five companies. And so that also speaks to the system that which brings up our politicians. We are voting on an extremely narrow spectrum of the entire society, of people within parliament. And for example, I can speak for my own country. Almost all of them come from Oxbridge. You've got they're all southeastern people within England. This is all of the UK. They're all connected. We used to have a system where our education system, it was funded by the government. However, they took that apart in the 1970s. It was a grammar school system, and it was half beneficial because it did allow a lot of lower class people to jump into the higher levels of society, network correctly, when private schools weren't a particularly present thing. Which I think, honestly, private schools within the UK, I'm not sure about private schools in Canada, but private schools in the UK, I went to one for the last 6 years, but looking back, I think it's a horrible system, because what you have is you do the same syllabus. About 10% of people, depending where you are, depending if you're in a big city or not, I would say 10% of the population go to these private schools. You do the same syllabus, you just get a better education of the same syllabus. You get more access to resources, more access to just, they work the system in a very, very efficient manner, and it's all about efficiency. And so purely within these systems, they definitely continue towards they maintain a sort of status quo where it's money that is important more than anything else in terms of how good your education is. But that also speaks volumes to the amount of the way that governments, I think you alluded to earlier, the way governments are, then they create, the people who are in control of the money, they create crises. And often when you have a crisis, that you do get this sort of reorganization of wealth. Wealth is not destroyed, but it's reorganized in a manner which is often hidden within the monetary system. When they print more money, it's almost like a hidden tax, because within inflation, the people who are closest to the monetary system are the ones who get first access to this newly printed money. Obviously, if you have money to begin with, it's very easy to perpetuate more. We've got this horrible system right now in place where I think it's along the lines of 95% of money is in electronic form, and 80% of that is sloshing around with these essentially gambling on Wall Street, in the East End of London or City of London, and it's sloshing around everywhere, and it's not actually creating wealth. It's just merely a form to sort of reorganize reorganize the forms of wealth. And so one thing is actually that's how is it, I know you're particularly pessimistic on the matter, but how is it that we can reorganize the money system, do you think, that would allow, in terms of values and in terms of, I think systems are more important to tackle rather than values. Values come from systems. And it's a system that needs to be changed, and a system that values money less, or where money has less of a particular influence over what you can do with your life. Do you have any particular solutions on that?
Well, I just want to first put a note here. I'm not sure that values come from systems. I think that's a two-way conversation that's happening. Nevertheless, well, what you were describing earlier with the private schools and everything, it's actually a caste system based on money. So what's happening is, if you are coming from a particularly poor family, then you don't really have many options but to go to your neighborhood school, which it's the same thing in my country as well. Like, I'm also from a private school. And, you know, we were having similar syllabi, even though not exactly the same, very similar syllabi. But the point was, like, we would have 20 students under one really thoughtful, educated intellectual who wanted to do everything to the best of his ability. And he would know each and every one of us, and he would help us, and so on and so forth. And the same material was covered in another school, say, a kilometer away, like 85 students under this one guy who's really not the best at his job, and he really doesn't care anymore. So what happens is, these 20 people, of course, come up with greater chances of having independent critical thought vis-a-vis the system, vis-a-vis their own lives, than the others who constantly need to see where the next dollar is coming from. So you do end up with this particular caste system where people who do not have the money really labor their entire lives trying to get at it. And people who do have the money can look at other luxuries, mainly how to govern the society. And this is something that we see that's a stable characteristics throughout the ages, like Aristotle from Plato, Aristotle and Hobbes, Locke, whoever. They were all people who really didn't need to look for money. They were all kind of rich, so they can actually sit down, relax, and think about, you know, I think we should be ruled that way or the other way. So a very large portion of society is constantly looking at the next meal. So they really do not have the luxury of speculating about, oh, what's the best way to govern us. So what they, I think what they're really looking for is some sort of stability that will ensure that, you know what, in a year, in 2 years, in 5 years, you're still going to be able to find good meals, and your kids are also do not need to be, you know, in the insecurity. You will have the security and the stability to send them to school. You can plan for the next 15 years and so on and so forth. And this luxury is something that many people are without, basically are doing without. Mm-hmm. So how can we replace this system?
Break down the caste system.
Well, yeah. Basically, you need to, I would say you need to start with the values. That the main thing, and I think this is one thing that I repeatedly underline in, I think, every lecture if I can, because this is one thing that really strikes me, that we have such a thing called the labor market. This blows my mind. Every time I'm surprised at it. It's not a labor market. It's people. There are people out there looking for jobs so they can get some money so they can feed their families. And then we say, oh, the labor market's not looking too bad. There's like 9% unemployment. So we're talking about 10% of society, people who can work, are looking for jobs. And this, to us, looks, that's okay. So there's this issue with the normalcy that we perceive within society. And so I would think that, you know, replacing these values, saying that, you know, it's really wrong for some people to actually starve to death and others to work 4 jobs and others to work like 3 jobs and take care of a kid as a single mom or whatever while everybody else is doing fine. So there seems to be this maybe redistribution of values in the sense that humanity, human dignity, and so on and so forth needs to be valued a bit more than probably everything else. Mm-hmm.
I think it was Marx who said that the revolutionary is the, I think it was a frustrated worker rather than the disgruntled consumer.
Yes.
Or that's certainly what I got from
it. I don't know if it's Marx, but
it's not
but
worked,
that sounds but like it.
It sounds, yeah, it sounds very, I got that from, I think it was some interpretation of of Marx. And I can definitely relate. We're going to move this on to into revolutions, which is the final section, and the way the internet is changing. But just quickly on that point, we have got, I did a presentation, obviously, in your class, and what I was trying to identify was what's in the way of social development, or what's standing in the way of more equality within our societies. And one of the main things was our growth model. I didn't manage to get it out in full, but we have a problem with our growth model where what's valued is this neoliberalism, neoliberalism theory that sort of came out in full force with Thatcher, Reagan, with this idea, and it's what China's trying to copy right now, which is what's creating all of these ghost towns where they have, I think it's something in excess of 100 million homes that can't be inhabited because they're too expensive, whereas they've got something like, I think it's 250,000 people living in substandard housing or no housing at all. So it's a complete misallocation of resources in there, and then to sort of keep their growth model, keep it going, keep it ticking, keep it high, they blow up bridges, for example. So they'll build a bridge 40 years long, they'll blow it up after 7 years, and then obviously that the blowing up costs money, the reconstruction of the people who remove the rubble, debris, that goes into the system, and then the people who reinstall the bridge, build it again, that all contributes to an increase in growth. And so this is something I think, and I don't know, it's going to have to be a conversation that continues later, whether values or whether it's something that can incentivize people for structure, that incentivize people, a structural solution that would incentivize people to other things. I think that's one of Adam Smith's main principles, that people do respond primarily to incentives. So anyway, revolution, which is what your thesis is focused around, and what revolutions are. You focused on the Tahrir Square, correct?
No, Tahrir Square is just one of the
examples.
The contemporary revolutions. I'm looking at historical cases. What I'm looking at is why people put up with being oppressed, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is not only a psychological issue, because there's a lot of psychological work on this, the Milgram experiment, Stanley experiment, and so on and so forth. But it's not only psychological. People are missing... Well, of course, not everybody's missing. There's also work in political science about this quite a lot, too, but not as much as psychology. What I'm looking at is why people put up with these authorities that are constantly victimizing them, that are constantly abusing them, and so on and so forth, yet they put up with that constantly. So I thought the right way to go is to see how these patterns of obedience came out to be, how they were constructed. So revolutions come into play exactly right there. I'm looking at the instances where people just say, you know what, enough is enough. And they rise up. And I see what the state does in reaction, what the government does in reaction to that, to make future revolutions impossible. In what ways state actors, once they experience this to them traumatizing event, try to block these avenues to make sure that this revolution doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. And so how does that what does that then change? Can you give specific examples of where they've changed?
Well, I can give you a specific example of what I'm talking about. And it's like one fantastic example that's right in front of everybody. So from, say, 15th century to 18th century, even early 19th, but mostly 18th century, the most common form of uprising in Europe is revolts against taxes. They're actually called tax revolts. There is a name for that. And, you know, In some 50 years, in, say, southern Germany, there's like thousands of them. In France, thousands of them. Small communities of, say, 500 people. There's this new tax, they rise up. They say, you know what, we're not paying. And then the Lord forces a bit more, then they just, you know, arm themselves and create paramilitary organizations and just fight back. And this happens everywhere. This community, that community, against this tax, against that tax, and so on and so forth. So what happens today is, there are no more tax rules because we're not actually paying taxes per se. They are deducted from our pays. So there isn't this tax issue is automated to such an extent that if, say, Alistair, you were to say, you know what, Henry David Thoreau is my idol, and I will, just like him, refuse to pay taxes, you cannot really do that because you're not really paying them through an act of your own. They're just deducted from your pay, no matter where you're paid. It's automated in such a way that you really have no say over this. So what happened over a couple of last centuries is that states experiencing these areas of disobedience have limited these areas to, with great success, I might add, to such an extent that our abilities, our spaces for disobedience are incredibly limited. So if you wanted to do something now against anything, the best you can do is just, you know, go out on the street and shout, which is very much encouraged as well, but quite ineffective if the people in power do not want to play ball. Then, you know, they can prolong this issue for years and years until they're just voted out of power in 10 years. And they can all the while pretend to listen to the protests and so on and so forth. So your actual effect on the policymakers, on actual policies, your reactions to them, they're pigeonholed to such a tiny extent that you really have very few choices if you wanted to disobey.
Okay. And what have you found to be the most effective forms of protest against the government?
Oh, it's always violence.
It's always violence.
Historically speaking, there's really no way out of this. Without violence, you know, we have contemporary examples, not really contemporary, but 20th century examples. People talk about Gandhi and Martin Luther and so on and so forth. And well, we have to recognize the issue with Gandhi and Martin Luther, though they were fantastic revolutionaries, that they were. Gandhi was fighting a falling British Empire in 1940s, an empire that was the death of colonial period, the beginning of it, beginning of the death of the colonial period, and so on and so forth. So these people were at the right time, at the right place. There were other people before Gandhi, not like Gandhi, do not misinterpret me, but there were other people who fought against the British, and they were massacred. And we don't really even read about them unless we have this particular interest in them. So what history mostly shows us is that people achieve change through violence. What history also mostly shows us is that violence really doesn't bring any actual change. Because, you know...
Sounds hopeless. Yeah.
That's the case. It's not about the revolutions. It's about the revolutionaries. So you break down a system. You know, you kill everybody in power, like the French revolutionaries. So what do you do now? And the sad truth is, people who now own the power, who now have the strength to do whatever they want, can only build what they have imagined. And that really connects to the caste system that we were just talking about. If you are the frustrated masses and you're coming from this, you know, primary school and high school with like 120 students in one classroom with one teacher who don't really know your name and so on and so forth, doesn't really know your name, you really do not have the experience to do something new. You just build something just like the old one, except this time you're in power. So if the quote that you allocated to Marx, saying that the frustrated worker does the thing, well, the frustrated worker does not really have the tools to build a better world. Mm-hmm. And Marx also recognized this. That's why he put the Communist Party in charge of the proletariat, because the proletariat is the great force that will bring about the revolution. But after the revolution, a new system will be built by those who have the imagination, basically, to build it.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming in. We're going to have to finish up there.
My pleasure.
Of course. You've been listening to Grievance of a Scot with myself, Alistair Melling, and Serbi Linturan. Tune in next week, where I hopefully we'll be discussing a bit more about abortion, and hopefully another hour of very, very interesting conversation. So thank you. You've been listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'll see you next week.